Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Well, hello. This is Chris Grimes. Welcome to part two today of another very exciting episode of the GoodListeningToShow.com here on UK Health Radio. This is part two of the programme with Brendan O'Hay, who has lovingly curated a book over the last 4 years with Dame Judi Dench called Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. So, yeah, listen to episode one to catch up to this point, but this is where we're going to pick up. We're still in the canopy of the tree. We've shaken his tree, and now we're up to... two things that never fail to grab your attention, which is the squirrels, borrow from the film Up, of distraction. So yes, this is part two of two of Brendan O'Hay. Enjoy the show.
Yeah.
So I think now we could be onto the squirrels of distraction. What never fails to grab your attention, borrow from the film Up. It's a bit, squirrels, you know, what never fails to, awkward, catch your attention, irrespective of anything else that's going on for you.
I've got a friend, he's called William Shakespeare. he's a failed guide dog. He's a retriever who's probably the stupidest sentient being I've ever met in my life. But I love him. I love him probably more than anything. And anyway, I shouldn't say that, but I do.
Is this your own dog called William Shakespeare?
No, it's not my dog. So where my partner lives in Stratford, I just happened to be walking into town one day and I saw this 7-week-old retriever puppy being carried in like a papoose. And of course I had to say hello to him, and he kind of tried to bite my hands and bite my ear. And then just by chance, I saw about half an hour later, this person came down the street and lived about three doors down from where my partner lived. So I became great friends with this puppy dog, and we would have play dates kind of 2 or 3 days a week where he'd come over and we would just kind of wrestle. I'd get him in a headlock and he'd lick my face like a lolly. It's all a bit kind of weird. It's weird now as I'm saying it out loud. There was nothing sexual, but I love this. I just love this beautiful, beautiful animal.
And by the way, it's so beautiful. There's a dog in Stratford called William Shakespeare.
Well, he was sponsored by the Shakespeare Institute, and they put a lot, it was the Institute, and they put a lot of money into this dog's training. And then it came the time where the puppies then get to a year old and they get taken away to Leamington Spa, and then they go into kind of, you know, proper training then to be a guide dog, all, of course, an extraordinarily worthy cause. And the thing I said to Suzanne, his owner, will I see him again? And she said, no, you'll never see him again. Oh, my God. Oh, God. Anyway, she said, you'll never see this dog again. What we can do is, in the future, we can probably see him in training. And he'll be the other side of the road, but we can't cross over and say hello to him because it'll affect his training. And, you know, that part of his life now, it has to close a door on that so he can focus on his future. And of course, I cried and cried and cried like I've never cried before. So it was to say goodbye to him. Anyway, 6 months later, she said, there's good news and bad news. I said, oh, God, what's the bad news? She said, he's failed his training. What's the good news? She said, I'm taking him back. So he's come back into my life again, this dog, this retriever. So he's about 7 or 8 now. And he is.
By the way, no is a good thing. He got no, so he can come back and be with you.
I said he was a good thing. Other people say, no, he knew exactly what he was doing. I think his report card said he was inconsistent. But he's just... But I think there's a kind of missing link there. But he's a retriever that can't retrieve. For instance, I've filmed him for 3.5 minutes trying to pick up a frisbee. Well, you think as a retriever, at least he can get some. He couldn't get any purchase on this frisbee, and then he'll sit and he'll look at his reflection in the oven door. But I think he thinks there's another dog. Then he's daring which one will blink first. But he can just sit. He's the most placid, beautiful. I love him. I absolutely.
He's like
love
your
him.
Greyfriars Bobby. He's always going to be loyal to you, I'm sure. And presumably, yeah. he was happy to be back. And in fact, why haven't you adopted him officially, please?
He was, and he loves it. He comes through the door, and we play, and then after about 2 hours, he's kind of had enough of me because I'm just I kind of wear him out, and I don't want to kind of keep on mucking about anymore. And then he can't wait to go. So I see him now probably every 2 or 3.
By the way, you've just reminded me at drama school I was analogized to being like an untrained. John Hartog called me an untrained Labrador.
I can see that.
I'll lick your face, hump your leg, do a shit in the corner, and go get distracted and do something else. Just to reassure you, I won't do any of that. But that was sort of the zest for life that I still have in terms of my own inner child and stuff.
You have. You're a puppy. You're still a kind of Labrador. You are, Chris. Very tall puppy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I cut you. Have you finished telling us the story of William Shakespeare the dog?
That's my
squirrel.
I love him. My other squirrel is Gogglebox, which I'm completely. If Gogglebox is on, I can't watch like 5 seconds. I've watched every kind of episode, and I've watched the reruns on Netflix and on Channel 4. I can't.
Oh, by the way, Giles Brander has said yes to being in my show in principle soon, and he's on Gogglebox, so that could be good. I'll use this moment to go, oh, Brendan and what likes Gogglebox.
Oh, yeah, Gogglebox. I love the celebrity one, but I love the one with the other one as well, where you get to meet the public. They're just stars in their own right. They're fantastic. I love it. And it's great about human psychology and some really good, like the Siddiqui's who live in, I think, is it?
It's great for people watching, isn't it? Which, of course, the actor's craft. Ducky, you should never be bored. Actors can always watch other people watching. That's
exactly.
Shelley again, obviously.
That's right. That's exactly that. It is about people watching, but it's just very, very funny. I love it. I really, really like it.
Lovely squirrels. Sorry.
So those are my two squirrels, yes.
Bless you for your squirrels. And now, a quirky or unusual fact about you. By the way, I'm quite excited. It looks like I might be milking 2 episodes out of you in Awana, which is great.
Oh, no, don't.
No, this is great. This is great. This is going exactly as I'd like it to. So now, a quirky or unusual fact about you, Brendan O'Hay, we couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us.
Well, you may know this, but maybe you don't. I am a trained fishmonger, and I became a fishmonger in Bristol.
I didn't know that. Tell us more, please.
Well, it was one of those things I thought, right, I think I might have been vegetarian at the time, but I thought, there was this in Clifton Down Shopping Centre. There used to be a fishmongers there. They were advertising for a trainee fishmonger, and I applied and I got the job, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. So, and while I was at Bristol, I would I'd go in the morning and I'd kind of prep the fish and all that, and do the window displays, and then on the Saturdays I would work there. And then in the holidays, I worked there. And then when I came to London, I worked in, it's near to Borough Market, but it was a little kind of outlet that we used to supply Harrods and Kettner's restaurants in London. So I used to drive in a van and supply fish in London. So, and that was a time where I hadn't worked for a little bit, and I applied for 2 jobs, one of which was to be, I probably shouldn't say this in case you've got children listening. You have very young children listening. Was to be Father Christmas in Hamleys. And to be a fishmonger. And I got both jobs on the same day. So I took both jobs and there was a complaint. So I would go into the fishmongers in the morning and I really couldn't get there. You cannot get rid of that smell.
You are a fishy Santa. I see what you're saying.
There
were lots of complaints.
There were complaints that Santa smelt a fish. There really, really was. I'm not even pretending that saying that just for a kind of cheap laugh. The only thing that would get rid of it would be coal tar soap. You'd have to really kind of rub that soap on it, and then, which was probably worse smell than the fish. But that was the only smell that could get rid of it.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
That's the coolest unusual fact. I'm a fishy Santa.
A fishy Santa. God. And oh god, we used to have a person who was of restricted height, little person. He would say that he had dwarfism. Well, he did have dwarfism, and he used to dress as an elf, and he hated it. He hated doing this job in Hamleys with me, and we'd get these often, I have to say, it was drunk office women. It was never the men. They'd come in, they'd want a picture with Santa. And there's one day they just got this guy dressed as an elf and they threw him on the Christmas tree. I mean, it was just, it was kind of mayhem. Absolutely. Yeah. It'd be much more, be much more organised and civilised.
Was it Hanbury's, London-based toys? Yeah, Hanbury's. So you were doing fishmongering and then you were commuting smelling a fish to become Santa.
Yes. I tried to get rid of that. I didn't intend to smell a fish. I would have a shower. And then eventually the coal tar soap would, but it would always, you know, a broth smokies would kind of break through the smell of coal tar soap. It must have been revolting for these kids. God, that man really stinks. Put them off Christmas. But yeah, so that's my unusual fact.
Very cool. No one's ever said or interpreted that in that way. We have shaken your tree. Hurrah.
Hooray.
And now this could be where we begin to talk about the work. We're going to stay in the clearing, move away from the tree now. Next, we're talking about alchemy and gold. When you're at purpose and in flow, Brendan O'Hay, actor, director, and now author. Presumably this is your first book, isn't it?
Yes. But hopefully my only one. I don't want to do another. I can't work with that woman again. So
It's a bit of a drop the mic one. It's pretty good if you can capture a national treasure, 70 years of Shakespeare in one book. I think that would be a bit of a drop the mic goodnight. But by all means, write a second one, obviously. So alchemy and gold. When you're at purpose and in flow, Brendan O'Hay, what are you absolutely happiest doing in what you're here to reveal to the world?
I love cooking. That comes from working as a fishmonger. So they'd say, you need to know the products. They'd say, right, there's a skate wing, go back, grill it, or saute it in a frying pan, saute it in butter, add some capers. So it was out of that I got a passion for cooking. I love cooking. My hero is Mark Hicks, H-I-X, who lost his business during COVID, I found out. And he's, if you can get hold of any of his cookbooks, I mean, he's an extraordinary chef. And then I just happened to be promoting the book up in Braemar. And I sat next to somebody who's just bought the Groucho Club. And now he's the consultant chef for, Mark Hicks, consultant chef for their business empire and all their restaurants, I think throughout the world, but certainly in this country. So, because I think he had to go back to scratch and he was working out of a van in Cornwall. But he's an extraordinary chef, Mark Hicks, and a lot of it is fish-based. But he, I think I might say this, he created all the recipes for the Ivy, Le Caprice, Shiki's, all those. Brilliant, brilliant. So I love the alchemy of cooking. I love, also it's that thing about, there's a point where when you cook, I love it when I cook something. I love spending a few days doing a reduction or a wonderful sauce or something. And I love it when people go, "Oh, this is nice." But then what I really love is when they forget about the food and the conversation takes over. And I love that moment where just you sit back and you think, "Oh, I've brought these friends together and they're enjoying this. I can see they're enjoying this food, but it's not now about the food anymore." And that's also similar to a rehearsal room as well, where you kind of, you're working with, there was a wonderful moment, I very rarely get it, there's a wonderful moment when we were rehearsing these plays for the Globe, the international touring productions. And I think it was A Midsummer Night's Dream. And in the room, everybody was doing something. So there was somebody doing a bit of choreography in the corner with a movement person. There was somebody working on some lines with the head of text there, Giles Block. There was somebody working the scene with the assistant director. Everybody was doing something. And there was just a moment of sitting back and going, look, all those people are being fulfilled and stimulated and being creative. And I just patted myself on the shoulder, I've brought these people together. And that was quite a nice feel. And yet it wasn't about me. It was about them kind of getting on doing it. And there's a lovely bit. You've directed, Chris. Have you directed plays?
Very little. I directed my own film, which was quite a strain because I was also in it and I'd written it. So it was a little bit of a big ask.
Okay, but you've not worked with a group of actors.
Yes, I have. I've done lots of drama teaching because I'm drama teacher trained. So I've directed in that regard. So I facilitate and enable groups a lot.
Of course you have. But there was a bit when there's a lovely moment that happens when I know it's all right, it's tracking all right. It's when, of course, I do a lot of prep. And then it's important once you get into the room to forget all the prep and just to see what happens. And that was a note that Stephen Pimlott once gave me once said to us as a company, when I did King Lear with him in Chichester with David Warner playing King Lear, And he said, I know exactly where everybody should be, whatever we should be wearing, the motivation of each line, but I've left all that outside the door. And he said, if we need to go back, I need to look at that or think, bring that into the room, that's fine. But it's all about what you bring. And that was a kind of wonderful note that I thought he gave us all. And similarly, you know, I try to emulate that. I do a lot of prep. And then you've got to see what the actors and the company, because the alchemy of that would bring something different. And you've just got to go with that. But what's lovely is there's always a moment then when you see the actors performing and you're still giving them notes, you've given them notes, and you need to think about your voice there isn't great, and you need to be in a stronger position there. You need to think more about what the other person is saying. And then there comes a point where you see it and you kind of know that you were involved in that production some time ago. And yet they've taken over, the company and made it their own. So there's no kind of scent or residue of me that belongs to them. They've just made it their own. And I wonder, I don't have children. I wonder, Chris, if that's similar to being a parent, where of course they're born, you know, they have their own minds and it's nature and nurture and all of that. But there must be a lovely point where you think, of course, I've contributed to that person's life, but they're their own person, and it kind of, you're part of it, and yet not part of it. Is that true of being a parent?
It absolutely profoundly is. It's the sort of the miracle of alchemy when suddenly that turns to gold, and you are only involved in the recipe, and then off it goes. So there's a through line for you as well in curation, because you like to curate and enable the alchemy, and then that turns to gold. And then this could be the moment where there's a natural segue into also talking about the book, because that's been a loving curation of conversation that lasted 4 years to release the book very recently. But yes, it's completely equivalent to being a parent too. That children are gobsmacking in their ability to fly of their own volition in a way that's stunning, and you know, makes you almost cry, weep on the daily when you realise what's happening.
Well, I'm not a parent, but
mine are 16 and 23, and the miracles keep on giving.
Well, that is wonderful. I'm not a parent, but that maybe the clue. Of course, I've got nevies, and I've got far too many godchildren.
And you've got William Shakespeare the dog as well.
William Shakespeare, the love of my life. Yeah, but it is that they're part of you, and yet they're completely separate and independent. And it's wrong to say I have no vanity. Of course I do, because I've just done my eyebrows and I tend to wear a hat to hide my balding head. So of course I'm completely vain. But I love it when there's no trace of me near it. I know that's okay. I'm not a huge fan on kind of flashy directors or flashy actors. It's because I think the job of a director is to empower the actors to be a conduit between the author and the audience. That's the beginning and the end.
And by the way, that does play out when I saw the show of you talking about Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent, and the fact that Judy's constantly trying to throw it back to you, and you're going, no, it's not about me. You are generally trying to just obviously make it about her, but it is a lovely double-hander in that regard.
But that was her being irritating as well, of which she can be. I also want your listeners to know that this isn't a kind of love letter to Judy Dench. There are a few warts in there. I bring out
I wanted to mention your first title, which you rather comically said should have been called Herding Eels, because of how wicked she is in a good way.
Well, I suppose that's my fishmonger coming out, isn't it? It was originally Herding Elvers, but I thought people may not know that that's a baby eel. But it is like she is impossible to pin down, because she's a child. She's an 88-year-old child, and a grandson, as I say in the book, you know, refers to as the most childish person he's ever known. But that's what makes her an extraordinary actor. It's this ability that she still wants to play and make believe. And
I love the idea she can't peel an orange without cutting a bit out, putting it into some comedy teeth as well.
God, she wouldn't let me use, she'll probably tell me off for saying this, but she wouldn't let me use a picture. There was a moment where she put the comedy teeth in. And do you remember that remember the canoeist and his wife? Was it Anne Darwin? Remember that canoeist? They said that this told the kids and everybody that he had died, but he was actually living behind the covers.
Eddie Marson has been in my show, and he was in that show. Yes.
I listened to that. Oh, that's a brilliant episode by Eddie Marson. Honestly, it's brilliant. I've been a huge fan of his for years. I thought that was a fantastic episode, as they all are, Chris. But that's it. Well, Anne Darwin, Jude put these kind of, she did her orange peel thing in, and she looked at me and she said, oh my God, I look like that canoeist's wife. So I superimposed her head on a body, on Anne Darwin's body, with these kind of orange peel teeth next to the canoeist. And I said, please, can we put this in the show? So she forbade it. She would not let me have it. So there is a photograph somewhere of Judi Dench looking like Anne Darwin with orange peel comedy teeth.
And the other lovely thing, this is all juicily in your foreword, which you very kindly put in, the number of times you've had to stop interviewing her because she's working at how many butterkissed she can get in her mouth at one moment.
I mean, it's ridiculous. I just sat there and I said, you know, the tape's running, and she'll put four through five for you, and then she'll laugh, and of course she'll spit them all over the place.
So the magic number was 45 before she had to. Well,
I don't know, maybe that was, but it's just an, just all about coaxing. I've just put a glass of champagne in there. Yes, I'm coming. And then she'll get a bit of, I don't know what is, a kind of Satsuma, you know, those kind of packaging, it comes in a bit of plastic netting, and she'll put that in a hat, or she'll wear it as a scarf. And you think, oh my God, you just got to let it run its course, you know.
I think that's why you love William Shakespeare, the dog as well, because there's something childlike and dog-like. Dogs are so brilliant at being in the here and the now. That's the important
thing. That's it. But she is annoying with it as well. I've got to go down today to do the Zoe Ball show tomorrow, and there'll be bananagrams, and there'll be cards, and there'll be, give me a Shakespeare quiz, and there'll be, right, let's do a drawing. And oh God, it is exhausting. It's absolutely exhausting. But once you get through that, I mean, she is great fun. She is extraordinary.
Yes,
but she just, obviously great, just loves life.
Love, yeah. And adoration there. So let's put your book on a metaphorical plinth within the clearing at this point now. We've been hearing wonderful insights of the story behind the story. So if you're watching on the podcast, you can watch it instead on the film. Judi Dench, Shakespeare, The Man Who Plays the Rent. This is obviously Brendan O'Hea, who has lovingly co-curated and authored the book. Would you like to read an extract from it of your choice, Brendan?
Oh, okay. I didn't know what to choose. I thought, do you want my own voice or her voice? But I thought, well, let's get her voice in. So this is a bit, it's towards the end where we talk about the future of Shakespeare. And I say to her, why do you love Shakespeare so much? And I say, why would you fight to have him kept on the school curriculum and performed in theatres? And she says this, she says, Shakespeare is an international language, a beacon for humanity and a bridge across cultures. His writing encompasses the minutiae of everyday life. When you come to do the plays, you often recognise something that you've never been able to articulate. He's able to express what it is to be human in the most concise way. And she goes on, there's something for everybody in Shakespeare. Everything you have felt or are yet to feel is all there in his plays. Oppression, ambition, loneliness, remorse, everything. If you need to understand jealousy, read Othello or The Winter's Tale. If you're in love, listen to Romeo and Juliet. And then she says, when I was at my lowest during the pandemic, I kept thinking of Richard II's line, I wasted time and now doth time waste me. Shakespeare has examined every single emotion. His writing has the capacity to make us feel less alone. And I think she's kind of nailed it with that, really. I mean, I think it's just kind of, there is something for every occasion. I mean, sadly, a friend of mine has recently lost her child. And I just kind of go, what, there are no words. And then I haven't got it at hand, so I won't even attempt to quote it. But there's an extraordinary piece of writing that Constance has in King John, where she talks about the loss of her child and how his form, the memory and her love for him, fills out his clothes. I mean, it's just kind of all there in those words, really. So everything you want is all there in the plays. It's I think she encapsulates that exquisitely in that little bit. And that's not to say that the whole book is kind of, not that that is pole face or serious. I mean, it is, well, as hopefully you will testify, Craig. I mean, I think there's some laugh out loud lines in there that are very, very funny. I mean,
yes.
She is, she comes out with some fantastic, yeah.
As it is described, it's a love letter to Shakespeare. And of course, the how he paid the rent for her, and obviously Michael Williams for all those years, which is where the title came from. So I'm glad it was that rather than Herding Eels in the End.
Well, I know. It's good. And as I say, it's knowing where to place it. I don't, you know, what's been interesting. I mean, this is not blowing my trumpet. This is what is out there. But we've had phenomenal reviews for it. But what's been interesting is people have. So, for instance, one person interviewed us, and he just wanted to talk about the darkness. He wanted to talk about the kind of legacy. I think he was looking for a line about Jude's, you know, that, you know, that she was kind of giving up acting now, but of course she wasn't going to give him that line. But he wanted to talk about, yeah, the kind of the sadness and all of that. Another review wanted to talk about all the sex she mentioned in the book. Somebody else wanted to know about, you know, about it from an acting point of view, because he was once an actor. Somebody wanted to just talk about the jokes. And I kind of, to begin with, I thought, I can't control what people think of it, but I thought, but there's also this, there's also that. But what's interesting about that is just, it just shows that people are responding to the book in different ways. And I just wouldn't want people to think, oh, it's about Shakespeare, I've never liked Shakespeare, for it to put them off. Because it, I think it's a much more about, I mean, people have responded to, as a kind of a testimony about our friendship. I hadn't really thought of that. I hadn't thought that that's what it's about. But it's about all things. It's about life, and it's about love, and it's about these extraordinary words. And that wonderful writer, yeah.
Yes, and it's the seven ages of man of itself. And that's why I'm delighted to say, obviously, there's a bit of legacy coming up inspired in this series of metaphors when I award you with a cake, which is what I'm going to do next, if that's all right.
Oh, yes, the cake.
So now I'm going to award you with a cake, Mr. Brendan O'Hay. So you get to put a cherry on the cake now. And this is stuff like and including what, first of all, what's a favourite inspirational quote? I'm just aware of the tome of Shakespeare. It doesn't have to be Shakespeare. What's a favourite inspirational quote that's always given you sucker and pulled you towards your future, first of all?
Well, of course, the one that came to mind, which I love Miss Piggy. I'm completely in love with Miss Piggy. But this is not the one I was going to choose, but I did think of her one. I think she's been interviewed by Michael Parkinson, where he asked her if she had what was that kind of mantra for life, and her reply was never eat more than you can lift, which I thought was an inspired quote. But I'm not going to use that one. One I heard recently which I liked was, which is the great Joan Collins, "It's amazing how lucky hardworking people are," which I think is a good one to pass on to youngsters. But I think my all-time favourite is a Robert Browning quote. I think I'm remembering this correctly, which is, "But a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?" Mm-hmm. And I think it's about, we have to go beyond our own perceived limitations. When I was casting the tours, The casting department, the Shakespeare Globe Tours, the casting department, we had eight actors who had to do three plays. And what we asked, they came up with it, that they had to come in, prepare a piece they would imagine themselves to be cast in, and prepare a piece they could never imagine themselves to be cast in. Inevitably, the piece that they couldn't imagine themselves to be cast in was often much, much more interesting. And I don't know why that was. Maybe they just took their imaginations off in another place. What profoundly depressed me was far too many people, predominantly girls, young, I'm talking about, you know, youngsters now in their kind of early 20s, would say, "The part I could never imagine myself playing would be Viola in 12th Night." I would say, why? They'd say, "No, because I'm the wrong size, or because I'm not attractive enough, or because of my strong accent." I can't tell you how profoundly depressing I found that. Mm-hmm. And that would be because maybe a bad teacher would have said that, or a parent, or a friend, or the pressure of social media. But you think, why are these youngsters putting pressure on themselves? And didn't Eddie Marsden say something like in his podcast, the advice of John Thor is don't let people find out who you are, or just keep wrong-footing people, and don't let people pigeonhole. He said it much more eloquently than I've just said it now. But I thought that was a great bit of advice. But I just hate the idea that these youngsters, just at the start of their careers, we're already kind of closing down opportunities. So, but a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? You have to go beyond your own perceived limitations, or the limitations that other people put on us.
And thanks so much for reincorporating that quote. Was it Robert Browning, did you say?
That's Robert Browning, yeah.
Lovely. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given, Brendan?
Oh, God. is this? Oh, God, so many. Look for the pluses in life, which Jude says in the book. I used to love, I always bookend every, it's a Rudy quote, which is, and I, again, it's mentioned in the book, which is don't believe a word I say. So I do love that. When I was in Ibsen's Ghost in Cardiff, we had 3 weeks to rehearse, and in the second week we were all feeling a little bit glum. Sean Phillips, myself, Lisa Palfrey, the other members of the cast, we were all feeling a bit glum. And the guy who ran the theatre, called Phil Clark, who wasn't directing the play, said, "Are you all right?" And we said, "Oh, a little bit down." He said, "Well, of course you're in Psyche Week, aren't you?" And we all said, "What do you mean, Phil? What do you mean, Psyche Week?" He said, "Well, you know, 3 weeks to rehearse a play. Week one, get him in and block it. Week two, Psyche Week. Week three, get on and judge." Now, I love that. What I love about that is because the middle period of any bit of creativity, whether you're writing something, whether you're directing something, whether you're acting something, there is always that messy middle period where it starts to do things to your head, Psyche Week, and you're in your own head. But what the hope is, which always happens in the third week, there is then that you will start to zhuzh. You will take off. But that is the process of all creativity. So, for instance, if I teach kids that are in drama school and they're in their second year, I always tell that story because they are in Psyche Year, and they're all going to, they get told, I know how to, they arrive kind of enthusiastic with their own instincts. And then, of course, the teachers throw a load of kind of other disciplines at them. And then by the year two, they don't know what the hell they're doing. And by year three, they've kind of assimilated what the teachers have taught them, and they've interpreted it in their own way, and their own instinct starts to come through. And the combination, the alchemy of that, then, my God, they start to zhuzh. But it doesn't have to be a 3-year course. It's a period. It could be a 1-year course. It could be a 2-week rehearsal period. But there's always that middle period where actors, creative people, hit the rapids. And that is part of the process, and you have to embrace that. You have to embrace that and not be afraid of that.
And hit the rapids, you're back in your river, the flow of life there again.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yes. And how are we spelling zhuzh, please? If we need to ever capture that, how do we spell zhuzh?
You know, I've asked all my, because it must be a Jewish phrase. And I've asked all my Jewish friends, and they all spell it in different ways. Zhuzh, is it Z-H-O-O-Z-H? I don't. I've seen different spellings of it. If anybody could let
tell
me
us,
know.
Yes.
Yeah, please tell
us. I love the quote. Yes, zhuzh. Best piece of advice, get on and zhuzh.
Get on and zhuzh.
Love that.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We're still in the existential zone. What notes, help, or advice might you proffer now with a beautiful gift of hindsight to your younger self, Brendan O'Hay?
Oh, my God. What advice would I give to my younger self? Oh, I don't want to say more kind. I was a pain in the ass when I first left drama school. There isn't much more. I thought there can't be much more to learn. I knew it all. And I lost a few jobs because I was tricky in a rehearsal room. One of which was, I worked with, my first job at drama school was with John Doyle, who ran the Liverpool Everyman Theatre. I played about 5 parts in a season there. And I wasn't very good in the company. I was just trying to undermine his direction. Or I was just a pain in the ass. And I always tell this story because every student I've taught, I just say, look, you know, especially if they're being difficult, I'll say, you know, you can carry on being difficult. Nobody will behave as badly as I did at the start of my career. So I wish I'd behaved better. The nice thing about John Doyle said, well, you'd never work with me again. And then cut to 15 years later, where my friend, the late Alan Plater, the writer Alan Plater, had written a two-hander for the Watermill in Newbury, and John Doyle was directing it. John Doyle did not want to see me. John Doyle was persuaded to see me, and I got the part, and we became friends again. So I was able to kind of build that bridge, and and I loved that experience with him. Mm-hmm. So I would say, are just trying to be a pain in the ass. Be kind, read more. And there's something that Peggy Ramsey, the writer, says. There's a very good book of letters. I can't remember who's curated this book of letters now about Peggy Ramsey, but it's really, really good. And Alan Plater, interestingly enough, wrote a play called Peggy for You about Peggy Ramsey, the literary agent. And there's a story in that book where a writer comes to see her and she says to him, are you right-handed or left-handed? And he says, I'm right-handed. And she says, find a skill that you can do with your left hand. And I love that. It means, i.e., do something that perhaps you're not good at. So going back to that with me at drama school, I wasn't very good at accents because I thought I had such a fabulous Welsh accent. Why would anybody want to hire me for anything other than my gorgeous, mellifluous tones? I mean, what an arsehole. But again, I lost out a lot of jobs on that. So I wish, and now I'm much better at accents. So if you can't play an instrument, learn an instrument. If you can't do accents, learn about accents. Reach beyond your own perceived limitations. So it's that's the advice, kindness. Well,
I'm really struck with the wisdom that comes from the desire for atonement. I so love that sense of realization of your own volition. You described yourself as being an asshole back then. I'm watching the Robbie Williams documentary on Netflix at the moment, and that sort of beautiful, wise but troubled individual who says the most profound thing about regretting how he was with Gary Barlow, which is just beautiful because it's the man you can sense they've made it up, but there was a lot of baggage. But then there's atonement, and there's something really profound, is what I'm trying to say, about the wisdom of atonement and the desire to seek it.
Well, I think you have to. That's not to say I'm not an arsehole now. And a lot of people, especially my nephews and godchildren, would probably call me that. But I'm sure lots of people do. But I think, you have to. Life's too short. There's too much darkness in the world to fall out with, the most petty things. Just because my partner designed a play called Vanilla, directed by Harold Pinter, with Sean Phillips and with Joanna Lumley. And he once travelled with her in the back of a taxi. And he said to Joanna Lumley, he said, Joe, he said, you're really positive. And what's your secret about life? And she said, life is all about having a good time and being kind to people. I think that's a pretty good maxim for life, isn't it? Kindness. Yes. Kindness is everything.
At this moment, I'm going to go, just letting a lovely little silence there. Lovely. So we're ramping up now to Shakespeare. There's two Shakespeares. This is the actual complete work. It's not the first folio, but this is the actual one I got to go to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School. So it says here, Chris Grimes, 16986, here. And then, of course, we've got your book, which is Judy Dench and Brendan O'Hay Shakespeare, The Man Who Plays the Rent. So we're just ramping up in a moment to talk about legacy. But just before we do that, this is the rather exciting moment, which is called Pass the Golden Baton, Please. So who would you most like to pass the Golden Baton along to now that you've experienced this show from within, Brendan O'Hay?
Well, I think my friend Finty Williams, parents, Michael Williams, Judy Dench, she's an extraordinary success story. And, living under the shadow of her parents, forging her own career path. She's an extraordinary person. She's got I don't even know the name of the podcast. She did a podcast about recovery and addiction with John McEwan I should have found the title for you. That's really, really terrific. I just think she's another one of kind of life's kind of life affirming human beings who is kind and supportive. So it would be my great friend, Finty Williams.
Thank you. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to furnish me with a warm introduction to Finty Williams. Thank you very much. And now, Shakespeare. So I've never before had two Shakespeare books in the same moment. It's very exciting. So don't forget, if you're watching and listening, you must go and buy or go and see the show and get a free copy. Thank you for the free book, please. Judy Dench and Brendan O'Hay, Shakespeare, The Man Who Pays the Rent. But now to the complete works of Shakespeare. This is borrowed from the Seven Ages of Man speech from All's Well That Ends Well, As You Like It. No, I'm confusing myself now. It's Jacques from As You Like It, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't know what you're going to say. Oh, I do know what you're going to say.
Yes. So this is inspired by All the World's a Stage and All the Men and Women Merely Players. Each man in his time has blah, blah, blah. Legacy. How, when all is said and done, Brendan O'Hay, actor, director, author, would you most like to be remembered?
Do you know what? I have no ambition to be remembered. I really don't. I don't. Not that I don't care. I just don't mind. In the same way that I can't control what people think of me in life, why should I aim to try to control what people think about me after I'm dead? I just don't know. Because, you know, people will think I'm funny and or weird or annoying or inspiring. Everybody who I meet will have a different opinion on me. And that's fine. That's their choice. I can't control that, and I certainly won't want to control what they think of me after I'm dead. So yeah, I've no ambition to be remembered. Yeah,
lovely, a great answer. Thank you very much. And where can we find out all about you on the old hinterweb, and particularly and very specifically, where can we go and buy your wonderful book, please?
So we're no longer doing the book tour. So we did our 5 dates because I think if it had gone any longer, we would have killed each other, me and her, Jude and myself. So you can buy the book in any leading bookshop. It's on Amazon. It's on Waterstones. And yeah, it's available now. So in all good booksellers.
And what we didn't mention, it's full of Dame Judy's illustrations as well.
Yeah. And she really resisted putting those in. It was only, we were looking at Coriolanus, and I saw, she doesn't have many copies of her scripts left, but there was Coriolanus where she had all these drawings in the side. And in the Coriolanus chapter, they are from the time she did it. I think it was 92. So those drawings there. And then during lockdown, she wanted to, I said, just try a few more drawings. And because she has macular degenerative disease, which is she, you know, everyone is aware of, her sight isn't great. And she started doing these drawings, and I said, can we put them in the book? And she would not put that. She said, no, I don't want them in the book. Don't want them in the book. I think they're absolutely exquisite. She puts a block of color down, and then very, very closely, she'll kind of put in some ink lines where to give the a bit of expression, but it's just the texture and the movement in these drawings, I think, are exquisite. The reason she put them in the book, or we managed to persuade her, it was somebody in her art group said, it may encourage other people or inspire, yes, other people with macular degenerative disease or eyesight problems to either keep on painting or to start painting. And that was the only thing that persuaded her. Otherwise, we would never have got them in. So I love them, and I love the way they break up the page.
And it is a wonderful bedtime read, because you can dip in and out, in and out, in and out as you go through the week of, you know, it's been a pleasure. I'm still in it, and I'm loving it.
Oh, that's great. Another thing to say, Chris, just to say, but what was nice is I met somebody who looked at it, and he's dyslexic, and he says he can't read books. And he looked at it and he went, oh, I think I can read this. And I said, why? He said, because it's broken up with me asking a question, her giving an answer, this space. And then it's kind of, the whole book is dislocated with these drawings at odd points. For instance, Jude wanted Julia to be up on a balcony, up on the left top hand side of one page, and the opposite page at the bottom, we got Romeo. So Jude has decided where all the drawings appear in the book. But because the kind of rhythm of what it looked like on the page, it wasn't just a block of words, this dyslexic lad said, oh, I think I can read that. So I love the fact that somebody who's got dyslexia was able to kind of think that they could be open to reading a book about arguably the greatest writer in the English language. That made me really, really happy.
And as an analogy that I got from it, it's a bit like having a jigsaw on the table, which is a jigsaw of the complete works of Shakespeare, and you just pick up these wonderful pieces, and they all tell a story.
Well, that's
wonderful. She tells with the through line of 7 ages of woman stroke man in the fact she's got 7 decades of Shakespeare.
Wonderful.
Hence love letter to Shakespeare, which we've said before, but that's just the cherry on the cake in it all, I think.
Yeah.
As this has been your moment in the sunshine in the Good Listening to Show, Stories of Distinction of Genius, is there anything else you'd like to say, Brendan O'Hay?
No, other than, yeah, don't believe a word I say. Yeah, honestly, just forge your own part, use your own voice, make your voice heard. You use the language to, yeah, just draw off the battery of these extraordinary words. And as Jude says, that these plays will make you feel less alone, because he articulates everything that we felt or are yet to feel. So, yeah. And thank you, Chris, for your time.
You're very welcome. And if I could ask a small favour, would you please play your episode to Dame Judy? Because I think she'll get an even deeper appreciation and understanding of you from this episode.
I will. Have I said anything awful about her?
No, you absolutely haven't. It's been a complete, well, a sort of a love letter and a love episode to the adoration you very obviously have.
Yeah, well, she's a good egg, and it's I think one of the reviews said it's a document of the kind of the last 70 years of British theatre as well, you know, because she's been at the top of her game. I mean, it is extraordinary. I can't think of anybody else who that's happened to. And you know, I've just caught her now. Her mind is still phenomenally sharp, and you know, she can remember details going back to the 50s. I mean, extraordinary details about costumes and names and where she was on stage, which I have no memory of my own performances. But she is, it is extraordinary. It is a kind of document of the last 70 years of British theatre, certainly, obviously, within terms of Shakespeare.
Well, just a final thing. I always ask that question, is there anything else you'd like to say, just in case I'm sort of working out if there's anything I've forgotten to say as well. It's very, very charming when you escort her on stage holding her hand because her eyesight is failing. Would you mind me asking how much of her vision has gone as a percentage now?
She can, I mean, she can obviously still draw if she holds something very, very close. I mean, if you're 3-4 feet away, unless she heard your voice and she knew you, she wouldn't be able to see you. I'm not speaking out of turn by saying all this, but it's not good. And obviously she's got a very powerful light, and that she's got big tiles now for Bananagram, so we can play Bananagram, and yet she can obviously sign her own signature and things. She needs to be close to the television. It's not great, but she just keeps on going, you know, she just keeps on going. Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Brendan O'Hay, and I've been Chris Grimes. Tune in next time for more Stories from the Clearing. Thank you very much indeed. And also thank you for watching on Facebook, if you have been too. And you've got some old chums watching you, I'm sure, on Facebook, the likes of Neil Bett. And there are quite a few that are going, oh, Brendan. And so I'll put you in touch with all those people.
Oh, no, don't do that. I don't see any of those people. I probably owe them money.
Neil Foster, all these people.
Oh, anyway, my God, that's probably vile to them.
Tim Hudson. School. No. No.
Oh, lovely people. Oh, lovely my people. God. Oh, how lovely.
Thank you for spending time. Good luck on the Zoe Ball show tomorrow. And
thank you very much.
Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you too.
I'll be in touch soon. I'll stop recording there.
You've been listening to the Good Listening To show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, from me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye.
So, Brendan O'Hare, you've just been given a damn good listening to in the Good Listening To show, Stories of Distinction and Genius. Could I get your immediate feedback on what that was like for you being curated through this journey?
As I said earlier, I what I love about your show in this dark, depressing world at the moment, with so many wars going on and people falling out, and I just think it's what you have is this beautiful oasis of kindness and positivity in this programme. And the big joy for me is, as I said earlier, is having kind of wanted to listen to one episode to think how it went. I've become completely hooked on the podcast and recommending it and sending it to friends. I think you've got spun gold here. So congratulations to you and your team. It's a beautiful, beautiful, life-affirming kind of 45, 50 minutes. So thank you.